Bouncy, I don't think got Carol's bio, but hers is much similar to mine. She also has done educational administration. She's been vice president for academic affairs at Atlantic Union College, has been department chair for the nursing department at Oakwood University, also at University of Michigan, Northeastern, was the associate dean at Catholic University of America. She also is a past president of American Public Health Association and also a strong interest in human rights and has done, we are Twin Solutions, so it's both of us. I wanted just before I begin to give just a very brief tribute to Dr. Alex Gatherer, who died in August. Carol, when the year she was president, brought Alex as a speaker on her presidential session, and he has since worked with the International Human Rights Committee, especially around the area of human rights of prisoners, and has been active with many of us that are interested in prison health. The year that I was president, I was fortunate to be able to give him the presidential citation, and he's been an inspiration to many, and he certainly will be missed. He died this August. Our topic is military personnel, veterans, and their families, a vulnerable population. We have nothing to disclose. This is a beautiful quotation from President Lincoln's second inaugural address that you're probably familiar with, to care for him who shall have borne the battle and for his widow and his orphan. Some terminology, Operation Enduring Freedom in Afghanistan, Iraqi Freedom, and New Dawn, which is also part of the Iraqi War. There are approximately 2.3 million active duty National Guard Reserve service members that have worked in been deployed in Iraq and Afghanistan. 40% have had multiple employments, some up to 18 months. Nearly 60% have family responsibilities. 2 million children are exposed to parental deployment. Women have increased up to 15% of armed services. If we look at the demographics, military parents marry earlier and have children earlier. 75% of these children are under the age of 11. Certain families are at high risk, especially young families, families with foreign-born spouses, recently relocated, junior enlisted, single parents, or children, families with children with special needs. TRICARE is the health care entitlement program for military families. Its benefits and policies are determined by the DOD. So it can involve direct military resource care or care from civilian resources. National Guard and resource members are, when they're activated, are eligible for benefits, but sometimes these are a little bit different for them, and that's a barrier. There's a widening gap between Americans and their military. Since the decision after the Vietnam War to end conscription, we're beginning to have more of a military caste. It's become like a family business war, and the issue with that is that it might be that the policymakers begin to see themselves as different from and other than military. These are two Civil War vets. We found, Carol and I are both Civil War history buffs. We found a very interesting article that looked at the impacts of war on Civil War veterans. And there's quite a database that looks at baseline data when they were enlisted and then medical examinations in later life. They look at the degree of trauma experienced and then physician-diagnosed disease and the age of death. So they have records of over 17,000 vets, that have been reviewed. Their findings included greater exposure to death of military comrades and younger exposure to war trauma that were related to physician-diagnosed cardiac disease, nervous disease, greater number of unique ailments across the life. This was the first study to use military and medical records to demonstrate post-war disease ailments across the lifespan. And they did recognize mental health problems that they called irritable heart syndrome. And, of course, Civil War is recognized as laying the roots of modern cardiology. Okay. Carol's going to talk about rural health. We were interested in this because of rural and also my experience in Alaska, where we have frontier people who have many of these same problems.
Mm-hmm.
The reason why we chose to look at rural fits is that many of the parameters, many of the characteristics of vets in rural areas are implicated in other problems of vets, such as problems of women's vets, their issues, homelessness, as you will see. 20% of Americans live in rural areas, and I don't know that you can see that map, but it looks at where people live in relationship to the urbanization or whatever of their communities. But historically, most of our recruits have come from rural areas in the United States. This is across wars. So while there are only 20% of Americans living in rural areas, 44% of recruits are from these areas, while only 14% are from major urban cities. And 30% of vets live in rural areas, and this is expected to increase as time goes on. There are many barriers to health care, such as long distances of travel, limited provider choice, lack of specialty services, inadequate provider supply, lack of cultural sensitivity. When we talk about such cultural sensitivity, you're talking about military cultural sensitivity, understanding the needs of rural military vets, and then the geographic distribution, because they're in remote areas, many of them. Compared to other rural residents, they suffer higher rates of depression, chronic illness, and physical problems. Compared to urban vets, they're older, less racially diverse, and this is changing, and less educated with greater health disparities. rural male vets are older than female vets. The age difference is, of course, explained by the influence of World War I in Korea and Vietnam, where you had many more male vets than women. And they're less racially diverse than their non-rural counterparts, I'm saying. And those are the statistics. But as I say, they're changing. Most rural vets are less educated than the population in general. And you can see there the degrees that they hold. There are three important trends that characterize vets that have implications for the future. One is the aging of rural vets, with 68% age 55 and older, and this will increase. The second is the growing number of female vets, so we're getting many more. So right now, women account for 8% of vets and are the fastest growing cohorts of vets. And then homeless vets. You see these numbers of vets that are homeless, 6,200,000 homeless on an annual basis, and they come from all eras. Cheryl and I live in Huntsville, well, she lives in Harvest, but it's like a little suburb, Huntsville, Alabama. There is a man that we see, and I have seen this man for years. I've been there about 15 years. You see him walking on the street, and he's a vet, people have told me, and you can tell that he has mental health issues, and he has a little bag with his belongings, and he wears a little vest, and he walks really fast, and he's out on the highways all the time, and you see him all over the place. But there's nothing that is being done for him. He's just wandering, you know, through the streets of Huntsville, and I don't know how he eats or whatever, but I've never seen him at the Downtown Rescue Mission that I'm associated with, but there he is, and he's an example. I think he's a Vietnam-era vet. Homeless vets represent 47% are from the Vietnam era, so you see a lot of them, and then 5% are living in rural areas. Although the majority are single males, we're seeing an increased number of females with single females with their children, vets, who are becoming the largest growing segment of homeless vets. Their most common diagnoses for rural vets: hypertension, type 2 diabetes, hyperlipidemia, PSDT, and depression. They also have mild traumatic brain injuries, becoming an increasingly important area of disability for vets. And many have amputations. Rural areas have the highest incidence of vets with service-related disabilities. The growing number of aging vets further burdens already stressed long-term services in rural areas. The more female homeless vets stimulate a need for more gender-specific care, and particularly mental health care, because female vets have more mental health diagnoses than male vets. And then the complex issues of homeless vets that have to do with a wide range of problems, substance abuse, mental disorders, housing issues, any number of health and social issues that these vets tend to face. The vets of the Gulf and Iraq wars have specific health areas that are concern. Injuries concerned with blast exposure, and you know many of them are exposed to this, that lead to mild traumatic brain injury. PTSD, chronic joint pain, they're carrying heavy packs over long periods, you know, long areas of in the desert or whatever, depression, substance abuse, exposures of many kind to pesticides, chemical exposures, and occupational hazards based on their work with chemicals and plants as they work with machinery during their terms of service. Access to care barriers include travel issues. This is their biggest issue for rural vets. Lack of transportation, limited availability of VA services, lack of behavioral health and other specialty services. This especially impacts women, vets, various other things as you see. Imperfect understanding of VA benefits. Many vets do not understand that they even can get benefits, much less what the benefits are. So this is a big problem. And then limited cultural sensitivity, again, of vets' needs. The travel burden is particularly significant for rural vets. Reported one-way travel distances to VA primary care services average 45 to 54 miles. Some of these vets do not have cars. Many of them are dependent on families or friends. Some of them try to use local transportation, but this is problematic and costly. The critical imperatives are to expand culturally sensitive services, improve coordination of services, increase availability of community-based services, because many times this is all that vets can use because the VA services are so far from them. Outreach programs, increased use of technology, and we'll talk about that a little bit later. Cultural competence of community providers needs to be increased because they don't understand vets and they don't understand what their needs are. In 2010, 5.2 million veterans received care from the VA, and many of these receive mental health care. So that in 2010, 1.2 million received mental health care. One of the key barriers and the most important barrier to vets receiving mental health care is stigma, and this is repeatedly seen in the literature. You read the VA and listen to them, they read what they say, and they say, well, you know, there is no stigma attached to admitting that you have mental health needs and coming for care. In fact, there really is. Cheryl and I were talking to a vet that came to my house to dinner this past Saturday, and he'd been deployed in both Iraq and Afghanistan, and he said, this is bunk. He said, your career suffers if you are told, you know, if you tell people that you have mental health needs. He said he had PTSD after his first deployment, and he said, you suffer. And so people are afraid to admit that they have mental health needs because they're afraid that this will impact them in their military career. Barriers are, as you see, seeking treatment leads them to feel that they will be viewed in a lesser light by other people. And this type of barrier is really, this type of stigma is really a barrier. Study by the RAND Corporation found that while nearly one in five returning from Iraq and Afghanistan suffered from PTSD, only about half of them sought treatment. So you see this is a potent barrier to health care. They're more likely to have two or more chronic diseases. The disparities really start in health for these vets after the age of 45. So you get this age cohort of 45 to 54 that start to have serious health issues that develop late. And here are the seven health problems that are salient for these vets. First is musculoskeletal injuries and pain. You know, this is self-evident. Mental health issues, which are severe, including dementia, chemical exposures to nerve gas like sarin, causes heart damage. You see this in some of the Gulf War vets. Infectious diseases. These are particularly diseases for which there are no vaccines. Noise and vibration exposure. Hearing loss and hearing impairments, ringing in the ears. Vets who work with machinery get vibration experience that can cause lower back pain, pain in their hands and fingers. Traumatic brain injury, which is increasingly a problem for these vets. And urologic injuries. And the problem there is if vets have penetrating urological wounds during combat, these are not considered life-threatening. So other things are taken care of first, and by the time that some of these urologic injuries are recognized and treated, complications have set in that require surgery to correct. PTSD is something that we've all heard about.
PTSD is up to 5 times more likely to develop in soldiers who have had previous mental health issues or had previous injury. So, and this is, this psychiatric status of the person coming in is more predictive of the development of PTSD than the injury severity. So people come to the service with problems and then PTSD it develops. Stigma-related barriers are, as I said, most important. Being young and female is a barrier to care. PTSD symptoms are positively associated with perceived barriers to care, so people with PTSD try to avoid treatment. And then the Army dismissals for personality disorders.
Okay. Personality disorders is considered a pre-existing condition, and it's a maladaptive pattern of behavior. Between 2005 and 2007, 1,000 soldiers were being discharged annually with a personality disorder, which made them ineligible for benefits, and in some cases they were forced to repay reenlistment bonuses. There was an article in The Nation, and after, in a big uproar in Congress, and after that the DOD had to change its policy to ensure a top-level case review to ensure that PTSD or TBI was not the underlying cause. After that, the PD, the personality disorder cases, dropped 75%, and only 260 were being diagnosed annually. In spite of that, the Army denies that any soldier was misdiagnosed before 2008, and they're not reviewing those cases and giving justice to those soldiers.
Before we leave PTSD, let me just tell you that I have a close friend and person that formerly worked on my faculty when I was chair at Oakwood. He is a mental health nurse practitioner. He works at the VA in Baltimore, and he told me that if a veteran comes in and is able to obtain a diagnosis of PTSD, that person gets care faster, they get certain kinds of benefits, they get retroactive pay, and if they have a psychiatric or mental health diagnosis that's not PTSD, they don't get that. So everybody is clamoring to get this diagnosis of PTSD because it has certain benefits attached, which is a problem. Okay, we need to move faster. Okay, suicide, as you know, is a problem. I'll just say one vet kills himself every 20 minutes. Every 80 minutes, I'm sorry. And then every 36 hours, one on-duty service person kills him or herself. So this is a big problem associated with alcohol and drug abuse. Again, stigma is implicated. Many of them have problems accessing care due to lack of transportation. They can't get local care and little access to technology, even though the technology is available through the Veterans Administration. Financial barriers are a problem for many vets. Many are uninsured or lack the financial resources to have treatment in a timely way. Women veterans are expected to increase up to 10% by the year 2020. They have a greater risk of developing homelessness, and as I said, many of them with children. For them, especially acknowledging that mental health issues are important is a problem because women feel like they are already being scrutinized about their ability to be tough. And if not being tough, they feel that they will have career disadvantages. Women vets are more likely to report poor health, remain divorced, become homeless, and 15% of them use VHA services. Institutional barriers or lack of knowledge, as we said, lack of availability of women's services, and their negative perception. They think that VA care is for old men. The cycle of deployment.
This was developed by Pincus in 2001. There are issues related to problems for families at each of these levels: pre-deployment, deployment, the sustainment, which is that period when the family begins to settle into the fact that someone's missing, and then post-deployment or reunion. And I'm sure you've read a lot of the literature on some of these issues, so I won't take that. But you know, you're in a situation where family feels unstable, dangerous, in a dangerous condition, and that their loved one is at risk. This is the first time in history that we have war in real time in our living rooms because of the media. And so while comforting, this leads to a heightened sense of fear.
Okay, one of the problems with military families, what did I do? Okay, is repeated deployments. They have longer and more frequent deployments. So many of them have deployments that are very burdensome to families and children. You see mental and physical problems in the wife and the children that are comparable to the problems in the service person themselves based on deployment. Divorce is climbing in them. As I said, children are having psychological and other problems related to deployments. We talk about parity, and this is a little booklet that's been put out by the National Alliance for Mental Health, and they talk about parity. Eligibility requirements are a mess. People have a very hard time negotiating the eligibility process to get care by the VA. People that are in the National Guard and in the Reserve and their families live in remote areas. Oftentimes, they can't get care. Veterans that seek mental health care find the system hard to penetrate, and 1.3 million veterans have no insurance. They often qualify for care, but the care free from the VA is only for 5 years, and many times these families or members develop problems after the five-year period. There's a long wait for care. As you see, all these claims, two-thirds are pending more than 125 days on first application, and the attitudes that are based on this culture of toughing it out.